Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon, the 4th of November. How did one of the world's largest oil companies, a leader in climate research, become one of its biggest public skeptics? The answer, Exxon feared a growing public consensus would lead to financially burdensome policies. For the past year, the Energy and Environmental Reporting Project at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism and the LA Times have been researching the gap between ExxonMobil's public positions and its internal planning on the issue of climate change. Reporters reviewed hundreds of documents in Calgary's Glenbow Museum and also at the University of Texas. They looked at scientific journals and talked to all kinds of experts, including former ExxonMobil employees. So we're going to talk about that, this issue, during the course of this hour on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Suzanne Rust. She is the senior reporter and editor of the Energy and Environmental Reporting Project. Before that, she was an investigative reporter for California Watch and the Center for Investigative Reporting, focusing on the environment. She began her journalism career here in Milwaukee in 2003 at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Suzanne. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we love to read your messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Suzanne Rust, thanks very much for being with us. Hi,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So it turns out that Exxon was looking at this issue quite some time ago, weren't they?
Yeah, they have been looking at climate change since about the late 1970s, as far as we can tell.
And what motivated that so early?
I think there were quite a few different things. First of all, scientists probably back in the at least back into the 1950s had started observing that carbon dioxide was increasing in the atmosphere, and researchers started putting two and two together and realized that fossil fuels were likely contributing to this increase in the concentration. And Exxon realized very early on that fossil fuels they didn't realize this. It was quite matter of fact. This was a product of burning fossil fuels, which is their lifeline. And so they were interested in what exactly was happening. And as Exxon does with everything, put an incredible amount of research into that area to understand it better.
Well, tell us more about that research. They went to quite some lengths to incorporate climate change projections into their future planning, didn't they?
Well, so they did. So initially, early on, and Inside Climate News has also done a fair bit of research on this. Initially, they just started looking into the sort of chemistry and physics of climate change. You know, sort of how does it work? What is happening? How can we detect it? And then they hired a guy named Brian Flannery, who was an astrophysicist, but also an incredible mathematician and statistician, to come on board and sort of get a better handle and understanding of this issue of climate change and global warming. And he started building global climate models that sort of looked at what would happen to the planet if, you know, so much carbon dioxide entered the atmosphere, or if the carbon dioxide doubled in the atmosphere over a period of time. These are very simple models, but he sort of played with them. And as time went on, his models and other models became increasingly sophisticated. And probably by the late 1980s, early 1990s, we discovered that ExxonMobil employees, or it wasn't ExxonMobil at the time, it was just Exxon, were incorporating some of those projections into getting a better handle on how their future operations would work. You know, Exxon builds things like offshore platforms or refineries, and these structures are often supposed to last 50, 60, 70 years. And so they need to sort of account for anything that could potentially happen to these structures. If they're in a place that has a lot of earthquakes, they have to put in seismic activity. Well, it looks like they were actually incorporating climate change, sort of a warming of the oceans, a warming of the atmosphere into the future in their infrastructure planning up in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm. And since they did their early studies back in the 70s, the Arctic has warmed. I was surprised to see how much it has warmed. It's warmed substantially, hasn't it?
It has warmed substantially. And in fact, the Beaufort Sea, which was the area that we sort of focused on because we found sort of the most research on that area, has warmed considerably. Back when they were looking at the Beaufort Sea in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the open water season, so the season when sea ice sort of leaves, was roughly about 2 months long. It is close to 5 months today. So there really has been marked warming in that area,
making it easy to explore.
It does make it easier to explore. It extends the season for construction and drilling and exploration. And I think estimates were made back in the early 1990s that construction and exploration costs would be reduced by 30 to 50%. Sarah Gerving, who went up to Glenbow in Calgary and found some of those papers and talked to researchers up there, by the way, is from Wisconsin. So a shout out to her as well.
Mm-hmm. So at the whole time that the Exxon was doing these big studies and finding out that indeed climate change was real and looking at the effect that it would have on their huge, huge business, they internally knew this was happening, but externally they're running ads in the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and the New York Times talking about how, well, climate change research is kind of murky. Why did they do that?
So we have two stories out now. The first sort of looked at what they were doing in terms of their Arctic business operations and how they were incorporating climate change into it. The second story actually looks at that question of what happened. So here was Exxon, who was a pioneer in climate change research, who were, you know, funding academic meetings, funding academics at Columbia University, which is where I'm based now, and was sort of just considered to be in the mix of all of this. And then something happened in the late 1980s. And their public position on it became very different. So while they continued doing research during this period, their public policy position became one that sort of stressed the uncertainty and doubt in the climate models. And what it looks like, we found a document that was written in 1988. It was a draft memo that sort of laid out what Exxon's position was. And sort of the lead into it was, there is a lot going on right now. In 1988, there was a huge, huge drought. It was an incredibly hot summer. People were becoming aware of climate change at this point. Jim Hansen, who was a NASA scientist, had gotten in front of Congress that summer and testified that global warming was happening. We were going to be seeing all sorts of effects from it. There was 99% surety from it. And ExxonMobil realized at this moment, this is really bad for business. And so in this document that we write about, they say Exxon's position should be to stress the uncertainty, emphasize the uncertainties. In fact, I think the way they wrote it. And over the following years, they funded organizations that really espoused this idea that climate change was too uncertain to base public policy on. They did put, very, very large ads in, big newspapers like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. Their CEO, Lee Raymond, got up in front of people and also expressed this uncertainty and doubt. So it was quite a change.
Yeah, quite a change. So what were they worried about? Everybody talks about excessive regulations, or those who are critical of some of the directions that are taken by some public policy people. Oh, it's excessive regulations. Were they concerned about excessive regulations? Because simultaneously, they must have known they probably were going to make more money because they had a longer period of time to explore and drill.
So it's a really great question. I do think they were worried about excessive regulations. Suddenly public policy, governments across the world, regulators were calling for reductions of emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, by 20%. That's a huge amount. I mean, that's asking people, like, not to drive their cars anymore. It's asking for, manufacturing and industry to cut way back. And ExxonMobil and other oil companies are what supply that sort of energy, to the world. This would have been a huge hit for them. And it was unfathomable to them that this could happen and would happen. I mean, I also think in their perspective, which is definitely a business perspective and a bottom line perspective, these kinds of cuts and reductions didn't make sense to them. They just seemed so enormous that there was no way the world could sort of fall into line. And again, they stressed that you can't base public policy on uncertain science, and particularly uncertain science that would also then affect their bottom line.
Mm-hmm. Was it quite expensive for them? You describe in the lengthy article in the LA Times from the early 70s until the 90s how expensive it was because the temperatures were freezing cold there. They had wicked winds and very thick sea ice. It must have cost them a pretty penny to do this kind of work in those years because of what the world was.
Yes, well, it was very expensive, and it's still incredibly expensive. So, you know, anytime you work in an environment like that, if you're working offshore, if you're having to deal with icebergs, if you're having to deal with, you know, very limited seasons, it's going to be a very expensive endeavor. And in the 1990s, there actually oil prices fell dramatically, and mm-hmm. that's sort of what spurred some of this research. There was sort of no incentive at that point to continue doing research or exploration up in this area because it was so expensive and they didn't see money coming back for it. So what some of their engineers decided to take upon themselves was, well, okay, so right now this is going to be really, really expensive, but if climate change happens, as people are projecting, in 40, 50 years, it likely will become much cheaper, you know, if we continue burning fossil fuels the way we are today. And indeed, it looks like their projections were spot on because although it is still incredibly expensive to do that kind of work, everybody has seen what Shell has done and how much money they've put into their Arctic exploration. It's just going to become easier and easier as time goes on.
There was somebody, tell me about who this was and when it happened, who asked I think he was a shareholder, who asked about climate change at a meeting sometime.
Yes, so that was, we introduced that at the beginning of our story on the Arctic. And in 1990, a dissident shareholder, I can't recall his name right now, but he was a lawyer down in Florida, and he said he was concerned about climate change. And so he and a group of shareholders got together and asked ExxonMobil, or Exxon at the time, to take climate change into account, to start looking at what kind of emissions they were putting into the atmosphere and to start paying attention to that. At the time, Exxon did everything they could to keep that proposal off of the proxy. And when that didn't work, they then came back and said, you know, this climate change thing you're talking about is very uncertain. So we're not going to address that.
Mm.
That's what's happened there. And then over time, they have continued to ask shareholders to vote against any climate change policies that are proposed.
In your recent piece in October, just a little while ago, I don't know who said this, but somebody said if Exxon had listened to its scientists and endorsed our research and not started the campaign that we just talked about, it would have had an enormous impact.
So I think there's a lot of discussion about that. If back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, had ExxonMobil listened to its scientists, looked at the projections that they were making, and cut back on their fossil fuels or started investing in an alternative energy, we would be in a very different position today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to know if that is the truth. But I did speak with a Stanford biologist. Her name is Terry Root, and she was a conservation biologist for years. She's just retired, and it was a sort of depressing take on things. But she's retiring, she said, because she doesn't think there's a field of conservation biology anymore. There's really nothing left to conserve. We conserve animals in particular habitats and regions, and you know, the climate in those areas is changing so rapidly that the species we associate with them will no longer be there. So I don't know if that's true or not, but I think a lot of people are concerned that, you know, the train left the station and there's nothing to pull it back at this point. And had something been done a while ago, we might not be in this place today.
We'll start taking phone calls in a moment. First of all, let's start with an email. Judy from Fitchburg asks you this, Suzanne. Is it true that some experienced lawyers and public interest groups say that collusion occurred among big fossil fuel companies to deny the science? Could the Department of Justice investigate under the RICO Act?
So I know lawmakers have asked the Department of Justice to look into corruption, to investigate Exxon based on the RICO Act. I am not a lawyer, and so I don't know what can be done. I don't know if there's standing for that. But there's been a lot of movement to have the Department of Justice investigate, as well as a new movement to have the SEC investigate ExxonMobil as well.
Mm-hmm. What response have you had from ExxonMobil to the series?
ExxonMobil is not particularly happy with the series.
I would imagine they're not.
And they have, so again, Inside Climate News has also done a lot in this area. We have both been accused of cherry-picking the research that we published and not giving enough credit to Exxon for continuing to look into climate change during the 90s and 2000s, which I think we made very clear in the story that they have continued to do research. I think what we pointed out is that their public policy position just shifted a lot in the late 1980s.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls, and here's how you reach the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter. If I don't add anything more, it's going to take forever to say all those things. Twitter, @KDunnShow. Our guest this hour is Suzanne Rush. She's senior reporter and editor of the Energy and Environmental Reporting Project, a two-part series so far that has appeared in the Los Angeles Times. How Exxon went from leader to skeptic on climate change research. It's a very thorough investigation. They interviewed scientists and went through all kinds of documents in Texas and in Canada. We'll be with you in just one moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. We start with George in Madison. Hi, George.
Hello. I'd like to thank the guest for the fine work that she and her colleagues did. But I think it's being treated a little bit too lightly. These Exxon people are, in my mind, criminals. There was a headline in The Guardian yesterday, it might have been this morning, that most Americans don't think climate change is a big deal. And, you know, they've convinced millions of people that there's nothing to worry about, you know, and they certainly probably were worried about regulations, but I'm sure they knew that fossil based businesses like theirs were needed to go out of the picture, and that's why they have done what they've done. I honestly believe that they're criminals. I'd like the guest to speak to that. Thanks.
Thanks, George.
Yeah, so, you know, again, the Department of Justice will be, well, I don't know if they will, but they've been asked to do an investigation of ExxonMobil and look into what sort of laws they may have broken. It is very clear from the work we have done that ExxonMobil was aware that the climate of the Earth was going to change as a result of fossil fuels. Again, looking at sort of how they incorporated it into their own business operations. Not only were they looking at how it might benefit their operations up in the Arctic, but also how it would pose sort of negative consequences. So things like permafrost thawing was going to make their infrastructure a buckle. So you know, I can't speak to really the morality of ExxonMobil's decisions to you know fund groups that continued to push for uncertainty and doubt in the public mind, but it is clear that they were aware that climate change was a concern, that it was going to change the Earth's climate, and that things were going to change as a result.
I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how effective that campaign was to create uncertainty and doubt, because there has been uncertainty and doubt going on for some years now, even though most scientists in the world say this is happening. There still is enough of that doubt that it fuels the, oh, this isn't really happening conversation.
Yeah, so it's hard to tell. ExxonMobil certainly invested quite a lot of money into that campaign. It's difficult to know. You know, were they sort of the leader of the campaign? Obviously, other companies were investing in that doubt and uncertainty, but that certainly has really affected how public policy has played out on this issue. The irony of it is that ExxonMobil works in uncertainty and doubt. Right? The whole oil industry is based on You know, where will we find the oil? How much oil will be down there? You know, what is the world going to be like in 50 or 60 years if we put our infrastructure into a place like Indonesia or into Nigeria? What are the politics going to be like there? Yet they every day they base decisions on this kind of uncertainty. So I do think there is a sense of irony that uncertainty in the end sort of stalled all of these climate change policies.
Yes.
And on this message from ExxonMobil, who works in uncertainty day after day after day after day. I mean, it's something they embrace in their business.
Interesting. Peter in Waukesha, hi.
Hi. Yeah, you seem to make a good case that they were trying to cover up something with those draft emails. But as far as the uncertainty, I'm old enough to remember in the late 1970s, I was in high school, and there was a fear of an ice age, the next ice age coming. And it was around long enough that there's actually the Milwaukee Museum has a very outdated setup where they've got an ice age scene that you can walk through, like a diorama. And I'm thinking, well, this is ironic. Here we are worrying about global warming, and we've got the global ice age diorama in front of me. I think there was some uncertainty, and then when you look at the early, I think it was the 1300s, they had a global warming then that turned around in the 1500s, and there was actually better crops during the 1300s, fewer people starving in northern Europe.
All right, but Peter, what we're talking about is the fact that internally they were doing all this research showing there was going to be global warming, and then externally said something quite the opposite. Can you focus on what we're talking about right now?
Yes, I understand that. I'm trying to focus on why would there be some uncertainty in the world?
Why would there be uncertainty in the world? So I'm not a climatologist. I'm a journalist, but I think it's apparent in the geological record that climate has changed, over and over again throughout. You know, the history of the planet. I think what we're talking about here is a different kind of climate change, one that is being changed by the result of human behavior. And, you know, what we showed in these stories was that, again, just as Kathleen just said, that ExxonMobil was aware that this was occurring, that they had done their own research on it, they were preparing for it, but publicly saying, there really is no certainty about this, and we don't know what's going to happen. So I'm not sure that answers your question.
I think it does. Yeah. Was there any evidence in looking through all of this vast research that was done for what you've done, and I'm sure there will be more articles in the LA Times, was there any evidence that Exxon was pretty alarmed by this and thought seriously about addition of a lot of research into alternatives to fossil fuel as their future?
And again, Inside Climate News has really sort of looked at the 70s and early 80s. But there was certainly concern among some of the scientists and engineers at Exxon. And in the early 1980s, Exxon and ExxonMobil is one of the most sophisticated companies in the world, and they are able to retain some of the best engineers and scientists in the world. And in the 1980s, they had all sorts of scientists, not just oil and gas engineers working on their payroll, but people who were thinking about solar panels and synthetic fuels. And they considered very strongly in the early 1980s different kinds of energy sources that they could diversify into. Again, something happened in the late 1980s. I think they became very concerned about the environmental movement. Lee Raymond began taking control over the company. He has made it very clear over time that climate change is something he was not buying into. And I think the culture of the company changed quite a bit. So again, in the early 1980s. There was a guy named Ed David who was took over their research and science, and he had come from Bell Labs, and he wanted to create a company that was very like Bell Labs, where you had cutting-edge science all looking into different forms of energy. And again, that really changed by the late 1980s. It was but at that point solely focused on fossil fuels. Mm. And, you know, that's sort of the position they have retained since then.
What do they do with all those old reports? Just stash them away and never look at them again?
So apparently they stow them away in the ExxonMobil Historical Archive down in Texas. I'm not sure if they realized they had done that, but that's where
they
are.
But they did, and you found them.
Yes.
Yeah. Peter, thanks for your call. Shane in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for your guest. I was wondering, in all of the research that you did in this, were there any studies in particular that were very convincing or were written specifically to convince people that this actually is real, that this is a big deal? Because it, for some stupid reason, in my opinion, I don't understand why people can't grasp the idea that this is actually happening.
So are you asking, did ExxonMobil write somewhere, or did Exxon write somewhere that this was really happening?
Either Exxon or anywhere else in any of your research that you came across. That I know NASA has some studies out, but I mean, is there anything that either Exxon or maybe not specifically Exxon that was very convincing?
Yeah, so again, you know, by the 1980s, I think most of the scientific world was in agreement that fossil fuel emissions, carbon dioxide, was building in the atmosphere. As a result, this potential enhanced greenhouse effect would come into play, right? If you put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, every physicist, every chemist knows you're going to warm it up. I think there was a lot of, and there still are sort of a lot of questions, exactly how is that going to play out? Things will warm, but regionally, what's going to happen? You know, in terms of humidity and precipitation, there is still uncertainty around there. But in the documents we came across, which included a board presentation, you know, drafts of Exxon's understanding of the greenhouse effect, it was very clear that they understood scientific consensus, agreed that excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was potentially going to lead to a warming Earth.
Well, you even talk in the article about Exxon outfitting an oil tanker with carbon dioxide detectors and analyzers and building models to project how a doubling of the gas in the atmosphere would affect global temperatures.
Yeah, so again, like, you know, in the late 1970s and early 1980s, they were really just trying to get a handle on what was happening. And they were, the issue with the tanker, it was a super tanker, it was called the SO Atlantic. They wanted to understand what was happening to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Was the ocean serving as a sink? And so what they basically did was looked at, and this is getting really techy, but sort of the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and in the oceans to see how much the ocean was absorbing. I mean, these were really advanced studies that they were doing, and they had a very deep understanding of climate change, of carbon dioxide's effects in the atmosphere, and they were seeking to know more about it.
Mm. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you want to join us, we'd love to hear from you. Jess in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jess.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What the question really should be is, what's the overall effect going to be of all the climate change? I'm not from the Midwest, but there are people who say, you know, when they were kids growing up here, there were snow drifts 10, 15 feet high, houses were covered. It's now November 4th of this year, and it's 70 degrees outside, and this is like unheard of. So the idea that it's not happening or there's nothing going on is ludicrous to say. But what we really need to ask is, who knew what when, and what's the overall outcome going to be? Because we are talking criminal. If simply in our generation we can make as much profit as we can, but in the end, if everything tanks, there's nothing left. So there's no profit in anything because there's nothing left.
Suzanne?
So I think, you know, I can't tell you what is going to happen, but I think there is a great deal of concern about, you know, what our world will look like in 30, 40, 50, 100 years, 200 years. I mean, one of the issues with carbon dioxide is it gets into the atmosphere, and it doesn't just blow away, right? It sits up there, and so it's going to amplify. Even if we were to stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere today, things will still continue to amplify over the next several decades. And so there was an article, an op-ed today, actually, in the New York Times that sort of looks at these issues. And one of the concerns is that, you know, the developed world, the governments, the nations that have money, will figure out how to adapt to this changing world. But those who are poor and without resources won't have the money to be able to do that. And, you know, things like, you look at these Pacific islands, you know, sea level is rising. Nobody doubts that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're becoming covered with water. What are they going to do? Or areas that are now not going to get the precipitation they once did. You know, people will suddenly be facing an issue of not being able to find drinking water and not having the finances to be able to build the infrastructure to tap water from somewhere else. I mean, I think we are entering into a world that we can't predict, and that's sort of what makes it, so concerning and upsetting to people.
How did you find that all of these records existed? How did you know to do this investigation?
My boss, Steve Call, who's the dean of the journalism school, wrote a book called Private Empire, which looked at ExxonMobil, the culture of the company. And he touched on, in a few chapters, sort of how they dealt with climate change. And he had talked to sources who sort of implied that ExxonMobil maybe knew more than they had said. And so he thought there must be, if somebody was just to take the time to dig a little bit, they would probably find something. And so he actually came up with this project idea and gave us, you know, 3 years to go to go figure it out. And so that's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's one of many things that we're going to be doing, but that was definitely an inspiration for this. And you know, I have to say, I started working at Columbia last September. I had 4 recent graduates from the journalism school working for me, and one of them read about this historical collection, this ExxonMobil historical collection in Texas. It's right out there. It's in the open, and she suggested she go down and take a look, and I was a little bit dubious, considering I assumed lawyers had been through everything that had been put into it. There'd be nothing there, but lo and behold, she went down. Found a lot of fascinating stuff, so it was a little easier than we had anticipated.
Right. How important journalism is, we have to remember, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks, Jess, for your call. Judith in Wausau, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment that I'd sort of like your guest's insight on, and that is when she mentioned that Exxon and perhaps other companies of a similar nature had the prediction that the cost of fossil fuels would decline, that perhaps even the process of refining them would decline, that means more profit for the company. So my reaction to that when I heard it was, well, then why continue to invest in expensive research on alternative fuels or alternative ways of doing things? Let's just ignore the research and go forward. Because by the time the flaw in the process was discovered or the crime was uncovered, most of the executives and the leading scientists would be retired or dead. And they would not be able to be prosecuted. I mean, I'm sorry to be cynical, but that's my view. Is once they had that idea, that this will all become less expensive for us to do, therefore we can make more profit, what incentive did they have to pursue an alternative?
Suzanne?
You'll have to ask ExxonMobil about that. You know, I'm not sure exactly what their reasoning was, but that does seem to be, you know, definitely a legitimate question to ask.
Well, as a result of what has been published so far, will Exxon be called before a congressional committee to answer?
It's unclear. I'm not sure. Again, you know, several members of Congress have asked the Department of Justice to investigate ExxonMobil to see what laws, if any laws, they have broken. They have also written to the Securities and Exchange Commission to also look into ExxonMobil's behavior and see, again, if they broke any laws there. Whether they will be called up to Congress to testify is unclear. Nothing in the works yet that I know of.
Yeah. We welcome our phone calls, and we'll take them in just one moment. We're talking about a very important couple articles. They're lengthy articles, and there will probably be more that appeared in October in the LA Times. What Exxon knew about the Earth's melting Arctic, and how Exxon went from leader to skeptic on climate change research. Our guest this hour is the senior reporter and editor of the Energy and Environmental Reporting Project, and they are one of the entities, along with the New, Los Angeles Times, that has dug into all of these files and files and files in Canada and also in Texas that looked at the science that Exxon was doing back in the late 70s and early 80s to determine the effect that climate change would have on their future exploration and drilling operations. And then they went from that to funding organizations with millions of dollars saying, well, climate change research is pretty murky. What if they had stayed with their original research and not gone the other direction? What would have done to the whole concern about climate change and are taking action on it perhaps a little bit earlier? It's interesting, very interesting, and important series. Our phone number for you to join this conversation, thank you very much, Judith, for the call, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, lots of calls. Let's go to Jim next in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm calling about a solution to the problem that we need to follow right now. And we need to get the public to support this. And the answer is a carbon tax and refund. The way it would work is that all carbon dioxide would be taxed. We're talking about fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, and it would be taxed. And then the money would that's accumulated would be returned to the people in this country so that you can afford it. In time, this will put up the price of fossil fuels. It'll give people money so they can afford it, and alternative forms of energy will be the result of our capitalistic system, is how I'm going to say it. But I belong to an organization called the Citizen Climate Lobby. If you go onto the internet, it's CCL, and you can find information about that. There's probably, I'm going to guess right now, around 10,000 of us in this country. And, I mean, if you read things like, now I'm getting ad lib, but if you get into things like Masters of Doubt, that's not quite the name for the book, but it talks about how they knew about all of this back in the 80s and how the science was there to prove it back then. Merchants of Doubt. That's the book that actually in one chapter goes through very well how they knew, how they could actually prove it from a science point of view being correct scientifically. And it's been known, it's just that somehow the propaganda has been fighting against.
Yeah, thank you, Jim, very much for the call. Are you in this series going to be looking at solutions, Suzanne?
Not this year, no.
Well, the year's almost over, so you've got another whole year, right?
Well, yeah, so at least in the next month of the calendar year, probably not. But we may be looking into that next year. You know, that's yet to be told.
Right.
ExxonMobil and other oil companies do now support a revenue neutral carbon tax on carbon dioxide. So that may be something that we will see come out of Paris this December.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jim, for your call. Let's go to Terry and Mercer next. Hi, Terry.
Hi. You know, one of the things that it always strikes me when we discussions is that somewhere along the line, some of the leadership in these companies lacked moral understanding of the issues at stake here. I mean, I have a hard time fathoming people in boardrooms who don't also have children and grandchildren thinking about the implications of their actions. And I'm wondering if any of your research found anything on how they morally supported their positions to obfuscate this information.
Well, I like your thoughts there, Terry. They're important ones. Suzanne.
So I can honestly tell you that every document we looked at was basically devoid of moral or ethical concerns. That did not come up. But I think what often happens, and I'm not saying this has happened necessarily with ExxonMobil or Exxon, but so people come at a problem with different perspectives, and you know, a real financial and business perspective was taken by a company, you know, on this issue, which, you know, would differ from somebody who came at it with a, you know, perspective of an environmentalist or somebody concerned about their grandchildren. So, you know, I don't want to cast any aspersions here, but I definitely did not come across anything anywhere that suggested anybody was, you know, sort of, let's think about this in,
right,
in a moral moral way.
But you really have to, Terry. It's your point. I agree with you. You really have to look at the moral considerations here.
To me, it says that there's something deeply wrong with our culture if people in those positions don't have a moral understanding of their actions. So thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's an interesting question to ask. You know, corporations are beholden to their shareholders and to provide them with money, right? And so, a corporation, that's what they're designed to do. And you know, whether those actions are always moral or not, I think is a good question to ask, and what the incentives are that we're run by.
So it's up to the shareholders to present some of those concerns as well, instead of one lone soul.
Yes, the shareholders do often bring these sorts of things up, and in order to make a change, they have to become a majority.
Thank you, Terry, very much for the call. Philip in Milwaukee, hi.
Yes, I'm a retired Air Force weather officer, and I finished my career in the Air Guard, and I went to numerous seminars at the American Meteorological Society, where I found out about this impending disaster. The only thing that's possibly worse would be a nuclear annihilation. But I believe the only way we can mitigate this is by passing move to amend or its equivalent. In other words, money is not speech. Corporations should never have the same rights as the legal people.
Yeah, Philip, we're having a really hard time understanding the last part of that. Can you move closer to the phone? Or I didn't hear the last part of that.
Yes, I was in a room that has echoes. I knew about this when I was in Air Force.
Right, we heard that part. Just
let us mitigate it by passing move to amend. Money is not speech. Corporations should never have the same rights as we, the people.
Tying it into Citizens United, Suzanne.
I don't know quite how to respond. I think you have a legitimate concern there, and you know, I don't know if ExxonMobil again broke any laws, but you know, the public should certainly be asking questions that you know, they consider important and, you know, sort of border on moral questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks very much for your call, Philip. Let's go to Bill in Forestville. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good.
Good.
I'd like to have your guest comment on any politicians that may have been, say, bought off by Exxon over this matter. I'm thinking of Senator Imhoff. He comes to mind first, but I know there's probably others.
So I have not. So this has not been part of our research, looking at how Exxon worked with politicians. So I can't really speak to that with any authority whatsoever. You know, I think this idea of uncertainty and therefore, you know, delaying or postponing or, you know, completely stopping public policy was something that really picked up in the 1980s and early 1990s. It looked like ExxonMobil spent a lot of money to promote that worldview, and you know whether they directly. And again, I have no evidence whatsoever. I've not even looked into this, but whether they were directly dealing with politicians or politicians were dealing with the organizations that Exxon did pay, I'm not clear. But there certainly is a large chorus of people and activists and groups out there still saying, you know, we should not base public policy on a science that's not certain.
Right.
So it really has caught traction.
Yeah. Oh, has it ever. Suzanne, from what all the research that has been done on the first couple series, have you now found yourself going in some place that you didn't think that you would go, and what might that be for what comes next in this exploration?
So we have we had initially, as we started doing this research, it always happens with any project that you work on for a long time. You think you know what the story is about, and when you begin to get information, it evolves.
Right.
We have certainly one more story coming out, which I'm sorry I can't tell you about until it comes out, and maybe another, but. It definitely, you know, particularly once we started publishing, you know, even more new things have come out. So I think there's still a lot left to do, and we will continue on this into the future.
So when does the next come out?
I don't know, but I would say in the next few weeks. I think that's probably safe.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, just in response to what you have written so far, who's been contacting you? Do you have other whistleblowers from other energy companies that are saying, oh, yeah, we have similar research? Was Exxon alone in doing this and then changing its public policy?
You know, no, we have not had we have not had any whistleblowers sort of. Well, that's not entirely true, but there's not been a whole lot of that that has come out. One of the difficulties in doing this project to begin with is that, you know, the people who were working on these projects or this research during the 1980s, 70s, early 90s are all mostly retired now.
Right.
And, you know, they receive pensions from these companies and they've signed non-disclosure acts. And it's a pretty big deal to get up and, you know, basically provoke the company that still provides for you. So, you know, it's just not been, it's been hard to find people who have come out to be
right.
real whistleblowers. But we, you know, certainly are hoping that someone at some point, you know, if there is something to show us, will come out and let us know. I'm sorry if that's not really answering your question there, but...
What about the Canadians? How have they responded to this? Can your article be picked up in Canadian newspapers?
Yeah, so the CBC picked up on it. Because Imperial, which was the company that was doing the research up in the Arctic, is a subsidiary of Exxon. It's sort of Exxon Canada. And so, yes, they were incredibly interested in the kind of research that Exxon had been doing and sort of forecasting how... the world would change. And again, the Northwest Territories, the Yukon Territories have been some of the most affected regions in the world from the warming. You know, the permafrost
right.
has been thawing and
yeah.
precipitation has changed. So, yes, they're very interested.
Thank you so much, Suzanne, for doing the investigation, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our
pleasure.
Suzanne Russ, senior reporter, editor of the Energy and Environmental Reporting Project, and we'll have those on our Facebook page, I reckon, the first two, and there will be another one. She won't tell us what it's about, but be on the lookout for it. What Exxon knew about the Earth's melting Arctic and how Exxon went from leader to skeptic on climate change research. So... we thank her for being with us. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and to Scott as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we will return. I hope you'll join us for the second hour of the conversation. I've been greatly moved by the people that I've met, too, who are associated with the Sikh temple in Oak Creek. Our guest found himself in quite a position as the newly elected mayor of the town when the horrendous shootings took place.